Coming up on Tech Nation, I speak with Brian Sager, the co-founder, president, and CEO of Omnity, a search engine not based on keywords, but search in the context of entire documents. Google isn't going away, but your need to find information is growing. Then on Biotech Nation, the promise and challenges of cancer immunotherapy. I speak with Dr. Sean McCarthy, the CEO of CytomX Therapeutics. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 minutes.
One out of every five fish that I eat, that Americans eat, has been illegally caught. Now, how can that be? I eat the most benign fish, not on any endangered list, and all from large, recognized companies or reputable local fishmongers. But where do they get their fish? And that starts the chain of distributors and suppliers, vendors and middlemen that all have to act fast because a fish is, well, a fish, and something has to be done with it soon after it's caught. And if you package, deliver, and supply fish, well, you have a very demanding supply chain indeed. It's a little like child labor or untenable working conditions. You can't tell by looking at a product what went into it. And you can't tell by looking at the fish on your plate how it got there. But this is a very small part of a very big story. Not so much about illegal fishing, but rather severe damage to the planet. And it all backs up to a few humans and the march of technology. New York Times journalist Ian Urbina writes about fish and the oceans when he writes about Palau versus the poachers. Palau is an island nation of 20,000 on a string of some 500-plus islands in the western Pacific. While they seem to have nothing, what they have in spades is sovereignty over a lot of ocean. And in 2015, Palau created a 200,000-square-mile marine sanctuary free from fishing and drilling. That would be over five times the size of Texas. Such a sanctuary is meant to keep out the worst of modern fishing technology. The purse-seining boats, which surround huge schools of fish with nets which float on the surface and extend their weighted bottoms to the floor. Some nets are a mile around, and nothing escapes. With the improvements in net strength over the decades, trawlers can scrape the ocean floor, devastating it, while again netting everything available. No longer is fishing interrupted by the availability of ice to pack the haul, as commercial freezers below deck stand ready for days. And FADs, the fish aggregating devices, meant to draw fish for easy netting, these dot our oceans and are perfectly legal. But Urbina writes mostly about the poachers who come into Palau's sanctuary and what Palau has been able to do about it. Palau has received the gift of a patrol boat from Australia, working with SkyTruth and others to utilize satellite tracking data. Which ships are where? Are they doing something they shouldn't? How can they be intercepted and checked? All this is supported from thousands of miles away. Data analysts from SkyTruth in the United States, with the help of computer applications and big data from satellites. You fight fire with fire, and it seems you fight technology with technology. And if the poacher's fishing vessel is any example, being a poacher is no picnic. These are horrific working conditions, attracting people who have little to lose, and for that matter, little to gain, but few other options. Reading of the devastation of the oceans, much of which is outside any nation's jurisdiction, lends credence to the idea that technology can serve to create an ocean surveillance state. And why not? Mother Earth ought to have some personal rights of her own. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Five Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, I speak with Brian Sager, the president and CEO of Omnity, a search engine which is able to search using the context of entire documents, not just keywords. Then on Biotech Nation, it's cancer immunotherapy. Dr. Sean McCarthy, the CEO of CytoMix Therapeutics, joins me to talk about their work. It seems like everyone searches the internet many times each day simply by entering a search word or two to get the information they need. I asked Omnity co-founder Brian Sager, what's different about Omnity?
An era of exploding data. There's not only an expanding volume of data, but also that data is being fragmented into ever more small silos, compartmentalized, inaccessible either by language or by physical access or digital access. So if you're looking for content, you don't necessarily know where to look in an exponentially exploding and highly fragmented knowledge base. That's the first issue. Search engines that were developed in the late 90s or early 2000s were in a different era of data volume.
You're talking about the Googles. Pre-Googles.
The Lycos, the Excited Homes, the AltaVistas, all of these.
There's a name I hadn't heard for a while. AltaVista.
Absolutely. All of those were focused on dealing with the challenge of finding information at a certain volume of data. And in the last 15, 20 years, that volume has exploded. And the solutions that were useful then are perhaps more outdated now. And in particular, if you're using keywords to search for a document and you've got a very, very large number of documents, mapping an enormous volume of information with a small number of words is very challenging. And you've seen this when you type two or three keywords into any search engine, the kind of results that appear are somewhat relevant, but oftentimes not, because the inherent challenge of mapping a small number of words to a large number of documents is very difficult. And this problem is only getting worse in the era of big data, where you have exploding volume, velocity, and variety of data. So how does one deal with that? The way we've approached this at Omnity is to not require the use of keywords to search, but rather search for documents using documents. So all the words in a document. Now, how do we do that? We actually leverage the structure of the English language. In the Oxford English Dictionary, there's about 660,000 words. And there's actually a larger number of words in English that aren't in the dictionary. But the top 10 words already represent 25% of all content. Take those out. And even the top 7,000 words represent 90% of all content. So you take the top 7,000 words out of a large number, and you're left with that large number of words. So we have a long information tail of rare words in English and a small number of very common words. Those common words serve as grammatical glue, but semantic noise. And so what we do is we look at the rare words in documents, and we develop a mathematical signature of the combinations of rare words in each document, and look for other documents with similar mathematical signatures, meaning they have similar distributions of rare words that are shared between them. Our fundamental thesis has been, and has been proven to be borne out, that if two documents have a similar distribution of rare words, they're on the same topic. They're implying the same kind of thematic content is embedded within them. And we see this over and over again. So what this lets us do is escape from the tyranny of taxonomy. And what I mean by that is we don't need to classify or categorize documents into silos. We don't need to compartmentalize them, which actually pulls them further apart from one another. And we don't need to set up citation networks, either using link analysis or bibliographic citations.
All this huge stuff. Academics know about this and researchers know about it all the time.
Absolutely.
It's just, it's like if just typing a few words into Google worked, all of these other things that are being developed wouldn't, you know, because
absolutely,
you can't find it.
Absolutely. And so there are different ways to approach, you know, search. And for us, what we've done is taken the text of documents and interconnected it to the text of other documents, not focused on the metadata. So the documents do not need to know about each other. They don't need to cite each other. They don't need to link each other. And yet we can still find them because they exhibit shared rare word combinations that are sufficiently similar to suggest similar themes are embedded within them.
So let's roll back just a little and sort of explain to people when they use, say, Google, and they type in a few words, and they get, of course, you've just gotten 33,000 responses in. Maybe you go to the second page occasionally, but you really only need the first few ones to get where you need to go. What are all those 33,000 responses? How are they? What does that represent in terms of information?
That's a great question. The knowledge in a conventional search engine masks the network structure that's contained within it. So when you see a tabular listing of results from a search in a conventional search engine, it's ranked by popularity fundamentally, how many links into that document are present, which is a validity for at least consensus.
You got this because when we showed the first 10, everybody clicked on the seventh one, so it moved up to sixth and fifth. And, well, we're going to give it to you first because that's what everybody
actually
is wanting.
It's a little bit different than that. It's the top documents have the greatest number of links into them, so it's a consensus
links from the
other documents
from the web itself,
right?
From other
right. So it's a static ranking that's periodically updated. And it's asymmetric link analysis into and out of documents that's resulting in their position in a search result. So the higher up in the search result, the more people have linked into that document. So it's presumed to be more valid because of the consensus that's implied by all that linkage. The problem is that worked great in the late 1990s when the web was much younger and there were many fewer documents. But let's say you've got a link in that's 1,000 links for a document and another document that has links in of 1,005. Are those five links different between the first and second document? Sufficiently distinctive to say that one is more important than the other? The challenge is the noise level becomes high when there's a lot of documents available. And so the signal of looking at asymmetries and linkages through URLs or even academic citations becomes very challenging. And so what you see is a lot of noise in results and increasing noise over time. You also have the impact of the search engine optimization industry, which tries to game the results to push them higher up. In our system, it's ungameable. We don't care about links in, so that industry is completely obviated. From the perspective of, you know, when you use a conventional search engine, I use them all the time. They're fantastic. We're not even competitive with them, because if you know exactly what you're looking for, they are a fantastic way to go. And I use Google every day. The challenge is, if you don't know exactly what you're looking for, how can you find it? You don't know the precise words. How can you pick those out?
Well, how do you do the context? I mean, just listening to you, I'm getting the picture that, boy, we've all gotten really good. If you type in a couple of words, you might even type in five or six if you really feel like, I really want a little more context here. But you've got to figure it out. That's just one level of wanting to search. Let's say you read a 3,000 word article in Forbes.
Mm-hmm.
And you're saying, oh, boy, I want to find out more about this. And the first thing you go to, you say, okay, well, what things do I need to type in, you know, to find out other things that have been written about it or are the context of this? And sometimes you give up. And mm-hmm. other times you get lucky, but you don't have any sense that you've gotten the full context.
Right.
But can an Omnini, for instance, say, here's my article in Forbes. Tell me everything that's like it?
Yes. In fact, the network structure of interlinked documents that's invisible in a conventional search engine is transparent in Omnini. You actually see the interconnections. You see how and why documents are represented. We have a word cloud, for example, which is actually an interactive tool as well as a word display, which shows you exactly why certain documents are connected, exactly which rare shared words are present in both documents. And so you see exactly the context of the search. We find people are surprised at the peripheral vision that this enables because they can see around corners they didn't even know were there. I'll give you one example. There was an article in the press recently about how Ford is an IT company. But, of course, they're a car company.
Really?
Right. And they were talking about...
Pick me up in your IT.
Exactly. Exactly. So that's a confusing concept because it crosses two knowledge domains. So if you were looking for support for that article, would you type in Ford? Would you type in car? Would you type in information technology or computer? You're not going to get the interface between those very effectively. What we can do with Omnini is drag and drop the entire article into the system, clip it off the web. We can ingest emails, email threads, and do a search off of the emails themselves. Any text document, whether it's the HTML of a web page, an email that's being ingested, a document, a text file, that PDF, whatever it may be, we search across the whole document and find similar documents. So if you were to drag that same document that represented the Ford IT news article, you would find patents associated with the technologies that Ford is using. You would find meetup groups and conferences that involve that topic. You would find faculty experts around the world who have expertise in this kind of area. You would find scientific and technical papers that you didn't know existed, you couldn't have known to search for.
Well, I just think about my example of the Forbes article.
Yeah.
It's a question of you can't read one of those without one, two, or three experts being quoted about something in context.
Yeah. Yeah.
That person and what they're talking about, if you're analyzing the whole thing, leads you to other information that you would have to do Google search after Google search after Google search,
right,
if you were so lucky to find it. So that would be included because it was part of the article.
Right. So we fundamentally are providing context around every search and the network structure that surrounds that search and enable kind of intuition to be formed by the end user who hopefully can hone their skills and pick out even more interesting articles to pull in and detect connections to that they didn't know existed.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Brian Sager, a prolific inventor with over 100 patents to his name. Dr. Sager is now the co-founder, president, and CEO of Omnity, a search engine not based on keywords, but search in the context of entire documents.
The interesting thing about this as well, when you're doing this kind of a search and you're looking at this over time, you can actually use the metadata to process the results in really unusual ways. So we can take the network structure in a graph and force it over time and parse it by organization and create essentially a timeline of different organizations or institutions or entities working on the same themes and see exactly who's colliding with who, even if they don't know about each other, don't cite each other, don't reference one another in any way, we still see these collisions. So what that means is...
You're not looking at the links to each other.
No.
You're looking at the content.
Absolutely. And the content is driving an agnostic view of what's important. It says these documents are interlinked based on their shared words, not based on the popularity of the folks that are linking into those documents. So it's a very different way of thinking about knowledge and information in general.
I think also for me is to sort of communicate to people or share with people, it's like, well, not only is your question to the great internet of whatever information is out there more complex now, more complicated, the answers you get back are bound to be more than just a click. You're looking for a whole lot of information that you can then move forward with.
Absolutely. And if you were to try to do this in a manual way, we've actually looked in the last 5 years of many subfields of knowledge. And by subfield, I mean a couple levels down from a taxonomic top. So in medicine, let's say you go from medicine to neurology to epilepsy. So that would be what we would call a subfield. In any domain of knowledge at that level, in the last 5 years, there's typically between 50 and 100,000 documents that have been created. Those could be technical or scientific papers, patents, news articles, conference proceedings, biographies, and so forth. So if you were to try to read each one of those, and it took an hour per document, and you had 100,000 documents, that's 100,000 hours. At 2,000 hours a year, that's 50 years. So it would take your entire professional life just to read the last 5 years of documents. Now, if you were to try to pairwise compare them to one another, which is what we do automatically, and you had perfect recall and memory at the age of, say, 80, and you spent 1 minute per pairwise comparison, which is absurdly small, but let's just say a human could do that, it would take you another 9,000 years to do that interconnection. So that's roughly the length of human recorded civilization, which is too long. So
I haven't got that kind of time, Brian.
Exactly. So we do that in a fraction of a second. It's a trillion-fold acceleration. So not only are we organizing information in a very different way, we're doing it very efficiently. And we're doing it so efficiently that it can let people leapfrog what otherwise would take years to learn. If you think about this is somewhat of a myth, but this idea of taking 10,000 hours to master a field, that's generally more for fields where there's repetitive activity, like playing the violin rather than being a strategist in a company or something like that. But let's just say that is an accurate number for the purposes of this discussion. If you go through that period of time, which takes several years, at the end of that, you may understand who are the schools of thought in a certain area. You know, who's working with who, who's not working with you, who's competitive, who's not competitive, you know, what's valid and what's not. And you'd have that sophistication from several years of work. The timeline that I described for you just now gives you that sophistication without taking those 10 years or 5 years. It lets you see exactly how the world is organized in terms of meaning in a way that you can't look at with any conventional search engine.
What I think is interesting here in this new evolution here, this new emergence, is that we've talked about for a few years now big data. And big data is like out there. And there are certain data scientists who can do analytics, which has suddenly gotten a big A, big N. And you're like, it's all, wow, an analytics. But it's still out there. And certain people and companies want that. It sort of takes big data and brings to the individual big understanding.
Absolutely.
Now you're bridging that gap.
Yes, exactly. This is democratizing big data. It's big data for the masses. And our public site is entirely free. We don't accept any advertising. There's no subscription cost. We have a second tier, which is for students, which is also entirely free, which adds open courseware.
And what do you mean by open courseware?
The kind of courseware that's available from MIT, Yale, Tufts, and so forth. It's been given to the world as a gift. So we take that and process the text and add that into everything else. So the free version that's open to the public has content like Wikipedia and other reference materials on it, certain news sources, meetup groups, conferences, different kinds of biographies. That kind of content, then we interconnect to the courseware so students can use this in studies or if they're writing a composition. They could, for example, drag a half-written paper into our system and find reference materials that surround it and massively accelerate the writing of their work. Their teachers could drag the finished article in and check for plagiarism.
Ooh, right? So, against everything and everyone.
And that will be very hard to hide.
You can't just, if we look at Turnitin, which is the classic thing all schools use to see if somebody's copied something, it doesn't check if you took somebody's paper and then just started moving the words around a bit. It's looking for verbatim things, but this would find something that this was
absolutely. That's exactly right. This will absolutely
turn
find
it
them.
In on meth. This is good.
Yes, it's a very intense algorithm we use that doesn't easily fall into the possibility of being gamed. You can't game the algorithm because
but we don't know how to game it yet.
If you gamed it, we would be able to detect the gaming because the statistical distribution of words would be so far out of the norm, we would flag that as an anomaly. So the only way to game it is an obvious statistical trick. For example, you could add the entire English dictionary to a document, but we would know that you did that. So, you know, so there's really no way to...
Oh, I like this.
Yeah, it's pretty strong. Research scientists are using this right now. They'll drag a scientific protocol in and find patents and papers that they didn't even know existed that are highly relevant to their work, probably from other fields that they don't have the time to read about or know about, find potential collaborators.
This actually, I think a lot of people don't understand this about academic research, scientific research, is that you're in your field, you're creating things that are new, you frequently are bringing in more stuff, and you kind of look around to everybody around and say, well, who are you quoting? Who are you reading? And I'm reading this. And then you kind of all, you have a tendency to sort of march forward together. It's like, well, you guys are the in crowd.
Right.
You guys are all peer reviewing each other's papers. You know,
the in crowd is too large. Every knowledge worker has the same sense of despair that there's too much information and not enough time. All of us experience that. No one can stay current in any field, much less multiple fields. So this is certainly true in research, industrially and academically. It's also true, for example, for attorneys doing litigation and analytics where they have a million pages of documents. And it may be wonderful for their billing hours, but they'll lose the case because they don't know what's in their corpus of documents. And we can drag a thesis that they've written, let's say a one-page strategy for their case, and find all the evidence points that connect to that in a fraction of a second. We can drag in investment bank reports from analysts on the buy side or sell side and find companies they didn't know about, competitive landscape issues they weren't aware of, intellectual property issues they need to be aware of, experts they can call and ask advice on. Some venture firms are using this to drag business plans in and find entrepreneurs, advisors, competitors, partners, customers, intellectual property they might want to in-license or out-license. So being aware of the world is an impossible task at the scale of big data. And in the era of big data, every knowledge worker has the same issue, which is there's no way to focus on what you need to know. There's too much to need to know. There's no way to stay current.
I'm speaking with Brian Sager, the co-founder, president, and CEO of Omnity. We'll talk more after a break. Podcasts of Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are available at iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show on Biotech Nation, the promise and challenges of cancer immunotherapy. Stay with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm speaking with Brian Sager, the president, CEO, and co-founder of Omnity, a search engine not based on keywords, but search in the context of entire documents.
So our knowledge worker customers in, say, the pharmaceutical industry, in the practitioners of law, people who are in education, finance.
Well, the pharmaceutical industry, yeah. It's people are coming up with new things. And they said, well, how do you know it's really new? What if nobody really published it or they didn't patent it, or they patented it but never pursued it? You know, that's hard to find all that all over the world. It's not just in the U.S. or in the country you happen to be in.
Absolutely. And the tyranny of taxonomy that I mentioned earlier comes into play here as well. Because let's say you've got all the grants in the world on the system, which we do, by the way. How would you know what to look for? What words would you do a keyword search on in a field you're not familiar with? It's very difficult to do that. But if you have an idea, you can see exactly what's out there, not only in the present, but in the past, and contact those people and find out more information. So this is a navigational tool for a massive sea of big data that no human can process. Google, I would say, and companies that are doing conventional search like that are superb navigators when you have a precise direction you're moving in. But if you're looking at the periphery and trying to cross fields, dealing with large amounts of data with small amounts of time, text-based connection, semantic-based connection becomes really important. They're complementary. They're not really competitive. They work well together.
Now, you've used the word taxonomy. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't use that word a lot. Mm-hmm. What does it mean?
It means a hierarchy of classification. It means ordering information into categories and subcategories so that you know what's there. The equivalent of this in, say, a clothing metaphor would be your dressing drawer, where you may have one drawer for socks and another drawer for shirts and another drawer for pants. And you know in any one of those drawers, you'll just find socks or shirts or pants. So the same thing with knowledge. You can file documents into different folders or categories or compartments so that you know they're there. A lot of people will do this with their computer desktops. They'll say, I want to store these kinds of emails in this directory and these kinds of pictures of my family in this directory and what have you. And so they're aware of where those are. That's helpful at an organizational level, but the act of compartmentalization creates barriers to integrating that information because now you don't know what's connected to what. The extreme example of that is the World Wide Web, because the interconnection of documents there happens in a very ad hoc way. People make decisions about who links into or out of their documents, right? They can change the code on their web page at any time. So it's the ultimate in an improvised taxonomy, which carries with it both the potential for organization, but also the potential for chaos. Because if you're looking for a cross-field or interdisciplinary idea, or you have an ambiguous idea or a complex concept that's too big to describe in a couple of words, you're lost.
You don't get it.
You don't get it.
And sometimes, and I'm sure everyone's experienced this, is you're reading along and you're like, yes, that would be really interesting. And you realize that it's created a link. Mm-hmm. You link on it and all it did was take you to, they didn't take you to Boston in the context of the innovation firms you were talking about. It just took you to the city of Boston.
Yep.
I was like, this is no context. Somebody was just, you know, well, I got to put a lot of links in, so I'll do that. You know, that's a mindless taxonomy that leads you to nowhere.
Absolutely. That, in linguistics, it's referred to as disambiguation, or the attempt to disambiguate. The classic example of that is the word duck. If you were to search for the word duck, are you talking about a bird or are you talking about a martial art move to avoid being punched? You can't differentiate with a four-letter word like that between a bird and a movement. If we had an entire document that was either a bird-watching document or a martial art instruction manual, there's full disambiguation. You would know immediately because you're not requiring a search. So this is a meta-level approach to knowledge discovery. It's going to take people a little bit of time to get used to it, but once they do get used to it, I don't think they'll be going back.
So let's go back, because we've just talked about that. You said in the beginning, well, we throw these words out and we come up with a mathematical expression. Mm-hmm. Let's go over that again. Now that we've talked about what this means, so go over that one more time about taking the words. You got your document that mm-hmm. I first gave, my example of the Forbes magazine article. Mm-hmm. What do you do with it, and where do you go from there?
So if you were reading online the Forbes magazine article, we have a Chrome extension that's free where you can literally press a single Omnity button. It will clip the text and run a search for you, and you'll see the result immediately. So in that article, we'll take the text, we'll eliminate common words, stop words like the, and, is, but, she, he, the grammatical glue but semantic noise. And for the rare remaining words, we'll mathematically analyze their statistical distribution, build up a high-dimensional equation of that distribution, and look for other documents that we've already processed that have a similar mathematical equation. And that's what creates our matching. The matching then is manifest as a graphical network structure, which the user can interrogate and inspect. And that lets them develop intuition for improved searches. And we show them the exact words that we're matching on. Then if they're interested in a metadata level analysis, we can show timelines, again, so they can see over time how different documents were created and who created them, parsed by organization. We can do this spatially with geographic maps that we built animation into, so you can see who's developed some idea.
Oh my God,
where.
There's a hot spot in Russia.
Exactly.
That we never knew anything
Absolutely.
About.
Absolutely. And maybe it's a traveling wave that's moving out over Europe, and you can't see that until you do that kind of analysis. We have another visualization where we use the query document as at one point in the visualization, and we show as you move further away from that point, other documents that are related semantically parsed by data source type. So it could be scientific papers versus patents versus news articles versus faculty biographies versus conference proceedings and so forth. So you can see exactly which data source types had what kind of content relative to your query. So this creates a level of transparency in the network structure that users have never seen before. And we've designed this to be self-service. We're not a consultancy. Anyone can use this. My 12-year-old son can use this. It doesn't require any kind of training, and it's entirely free.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Brian Sager, the president and CEO of Omnity, a search engine not based on keywords, but search in the context of entire documents. Now, what's free, and for what are you going to charge?
So the public tier, it contains reference materials like Wikipedia.
And it's available now?
It's available today. And it has news archives on it, interconnected as well. The TED Talks are on there, lots of faculty biographies, all the meetup groups in the world, that kind of content. So entirely free. The student version of that layers on top OpenCourseWare from some of the major universities in the world. Also entirely free, but you need an EDU or equivalent email address to access it as a student. The paid subscription tiers we'll be coming out with in the late spring of this year, and they're focused on the enterprise. And our business model is to have subscriptions on a monthly per user per seat basis for those. So we still have no advertising. But the subscription pricing, which we haven't yet announced, will be extremely low. It'll be in the noise for most companies. They'll be able to buy this on credit card, you know, that kind of thing. So, there's companies out there that are doing consultancy-based work with big data that requires, you know, seven-figure annual budgets to have just a few user seats. We're not interested in that kind of biz model. We actually want to democratize big data for the enterprise as well. And we'll be able to do that in several ways. We enable the access of the users to different specialist bundles of content. We have one for bioscience, one for medicine, law, finance, engineering, and so forth. So the primary use case there might be for users in that particular domain. That's the professional level of use. The next level up, which we call executive, is the professional level, but each of those buckets of specialist content have been interconnected fully with each other. So it's as full a view of the world as you can get across all disciplines. The next tier up from that will be at the enterprise level, and we take that public corpus of documents and interconnect it behind the firewall to an individual company's set of documents.
Their personal documents, their company confidential documents.
Absolutely. So a pharmaceutical company could have, say, clinical trial records for a drug in development, and they may have 100,000 pages from an electronic lab notebook. We can interconnect that within itself and then interconnect it to all the patents, papers, people, places, things in the world that are relevant. Likewise, if you had an ERP system like SAP or Oracle or
Enterprise,
Enterprise resource planning.
Resource planning, yes.
Yeah, so the systems that basically are running the operations of a company, all the text documents could be interconnected to the outside world. So SAP or Oracle might have a billion documents in their store system. So maybe, let's say 10% of those are text files. So you have 100 million text files. Those could be sales orders, emails, legal contracts, resumes, performance reviews, marketing material, and so forth, vendor qualifications, supply chain notes. We can connect all of that to itself and then into the outside world as well. So that essentially becomes a bolt-on to an ERP system. It becomes the nervous system of a company. It lets it understand, so to speak, the implications
where
of that
data.
Where
it is in the world of information.
Exactly. The places context. It.
Exactly. Their context
yeah.
in the world of all the information available. You know, I'm one thing that kind of went by fast, but I want to say that we see the precedent for this in technology, as you were saying. Well, you used to have to hire, you know, all these massive consultants, and it cost you, you know, millions of dollars and all these kind of things. And that's really what it took with the technology available and what we knew. And the information was growing phenomenally, more than our ability to deal with it. And then, well, we don't want to charge that much. We don't have to charge that much. And they say, well, how can you do that? Does that ever happen? And I think a great recent example that people can understand is that one of my students, who happened to be a high-level manager, actually, for a very large global pharmaceutical firm, was in charge of developing an information system where parents could come on and put pictures of their babies and anything when they were like trying to bring, oh yeah, put them all up on here and we'll help you all this. And this was just a handful of years ago. And he got a number of quotes for what it would take for all this storage and then backup storage. And they were talking in the $500,000, $600,000, you know, range about what it would take. And then you had the operating cost and things. And then he had a conversation with the first of the cloud, we're going to give you storage in the cloud, people. And they said, oh, we can do all this, and then it'll take you a couple of seconds if they haven't accessed the pictures in like 3 months. We have to come go to our deeper archive. And they said, how much would it be? And he said, it was ridiculous. It was like $100 a month, and this is just really great. We don't have to deal with anything. We don't have to build a data center. And he says, yeah, it was $100 a month. And they said, no, we just need your credit card number. Mm-hmm. And he goes, credit card number? I can't put this on my credit card. I can travel on my credit card, but I can't buy storage on my credit card. So the company had to change their buying policies. Mm-hmm. It can happen that fast.
Absolutely. And in fact, that's how we operate. We are in the cloud. We use all the standard elastic computing resources, which has enabled us to not need to build a data farm somewhere. And that's what's driven our cost of goods sold down to a level where we can offer this at a very low price. So it's the preponderance of elastic computing resources that has enabled us to move so fast and so efficiently.
Well, you've been working on this for 4 years. I didn't know you were working on this. I hadn't heard this. And I hear you're in stealth mode. You're finally out and ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
What did you do for 4 years? What were the challenges? And why were you in stealth mode?
We did not want to be distracted. We have a lot of funding, which we have not announced. So we didn't have a need to be out there. We were in private beta working with customers, doing a lot of user tests on the front end of the software development process. And on the back end, we were both developing the mathematical algorithms and making sure that they worked as well as they needed to and as well as they could, and also dealing with big data issues. Anybody who works with big data will tell you the biggest problem is data cleanliness. In other words, how clean the data is impacts everything. And that is defined by a combination of factors, including the consistency of formatting of documents, the clarity of how they're formatted. So are they well structured, say an XML code, for example, and do we know of a standard format? Are there spelling errors? Are there typographical errors?
You learned a lot in the last 4 years.
Are there missing data? Yeah. So we've figured out ways to take data that's not perfectly structured, including a lot of federal government data, and put it into a structure that allows for continuous reuse by everybody. So that's been part of the process. The mathematical algorithms have been part of this process. And we've developed our code in a mathematical language called Haskell, which is the 23rd most popular computing language. Not very popular.
That's kind of stealth in itself.
It kind of is, although Facebook's using it now too. Several big, and I know there's some folks at Google doing that too. But it's a mathematical language. It lets you describe your algorithmic intent with mathematical equations, which was very well suited towards our philosophical view on how to create a contextually relevant search.
So it's Omnity, O-M-N-I-T-Y, Omnity.io.
Yes.
How'd you come up with that name?
The I-T-Y at the end means the state of.
So
The itty, yeah. So if you had a word like frigidity or stability, both of those, frigidity, the state of coldness, stability, the state of motionless, or at least not moving very much, right? So omnity is the state of omni, omni meaning all or everything. So it's the state of everything. So the idea there is that we're leveraging the interconnection of knowledge to allow insight. And the om of omnity is a kind of meditative motif that is intended to suggest that perhaps one can achieve inspiration from that. In fact, our logo is an Enzo, which is a Taoist symbol, but it's made out of a network structure. So the ink with which we draw the Enzo are small circular nodes and lines. The circles represent documents, and the lines, links, or edges between those nodes or circles represent the semantic interconnection, all to enable inspiration.
Well, this has been very inspiring, Brian. I hope you come back. Keep us updated, won't you?
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Dr. Brian Sager is the co-founder, president, and CEO of Omnity, a search engine not based on keywords, but the context of entire documents. I was able to catch up with Brian at the Consumer Electronics Show, CES 2016, in Las Vegas, Nevada. More information is available at omnity.io. That's Omnity, O-M-N-I-T-I, omnity.io. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. The world we know is changing. Welcome to Biotech Nation. Today on Biotech Nation, the promise and challenges of cancer immunotherapy. Traditionally, we've associated cancer treatment with severe side effects. I asked Dr. Sean McCarthy, the CEO of CytomX Therapeutics, why is that?
Well, we've seen tremendous advances in the last 5-10 years in the treatment of cancer with a wide range of different modalities, different types of therapeutics. And of course, the goal is to eliminate the cancer as far as one can. And some of the most recent advances in the field of immunotherapy are achieving that. Some patients are going into long-term durable remission, even in diseases as terrible as late-stage melanoma. So the field historically has looked for therapies that will hit the cancer hard. Now, of course, what often happens is the collateral damage of hitting the cancer hard is that you also hit the patient hard. And this historically has been true of cancer chemotherapy. It also is true today in this new field of immunotherapy, but for different reasons. So whereas chemotherapy is effectively a poison designed to poison the tumor cell before it poisons the body, the immunotherapy approach is designed to activate a patient's immune system to recognize the tumor and eliminate it. Now, what also occurs when you activate a patient's immune system is we see broad-based autoimmune toxicities because we're activating the immune system throughout the patient's entire body. For example, colitis or autoimmune hepatitis. And so it's a different set of side effects, which oncologists take great efforts to try to control with co-administering other drugs like steroids, for example. And so there's a big effort in managing these side effects. Of course, it would be preferred to avoid them if we can, and that's where our technology comes in at CytomX.
What are you doing there?
Well, we're developing a new platform of antibody therapeutics we call probodies. Probodies are designed to be activated only in tumor tissue and not throughout the rest of the body. And so we focus the activity in tumor tissue and thereby allowing safer, more effective therapies. And our vision statement for our company is transforming lives with safer, more effective therapies.
Many of the new immunotherapies are coming through with antibodies that can attach to the cancer cells, but they can also attach to other cells. Is that part of the reason we have side effects?
That's a major reason. That's right. One way to think about it is that immune therapy can set off the equivalent of a 5-alarm fire in the immune system, which is great to eradicate the tumor, but not so great for other tissues. And what we believe is underlying this, these toxicities throughout the body, is that the reason that immunotherapy for the cancer works is that cancer is very smart. Cancer can avoid the immune system by effectively cloaking itself. And these new therapies, such as Yervoy from Bristol-Myers, Keytruda from Merck, these therapies are designed to uncloak the tumor so that the immune system can recognize the cancer cells and eliminate them. The challenge is that the uncloaking is not specific to the tumor. It happens throughout the body. And immune cells that typically are switched off and unable to recognize normal tissue are switched on and now do recognize normal tissue and cause autoimmune side effects. So it's this uncloaking that we're trying to focus into the tumor and avoid the systemic effects.
How does it work?
Well, so the probody approach goes back actually to some foundational science that was done at UC Santa Barbara, which is where our founding scientist, Professor Patrick Doherty, works. And Patrick had the idea that you could, by taking an antibody and putting a mask on it, you could prevent the antibody binding normal tissue. And if you rendered the mask removable by proteins in tumor.
Only in cancer.
And
tumors.
Only in cancer, you could activate the antibody in tumor tissue, thereby sparing healthy tissue of the side effects. So so it was a big idea at the time, kind of an elegant idea in the antibody world that was sufficient to draw substantial venture capital investment. And that's what we've been working to reduce to practice over the last several years. In some ways, Patrick, he took two and two and made five, if you like, out of this this approach and came up with this very novel idea.
The cloaking device. We love this. It's so Star Trek, you know.
Yeah. So we refer to the concept as masking, and masking again being a way to blunt systemic toxicity, but focus the activity of the antibody in cancer.
So where are you with all this?
So we have some very exciting molecules in preclinical studies that we are aiming to move towards the clinic next year. So we'll be filing our first investigational new drug application in 2016, and our first clinical data should come in the couple of years following that.
Well, do you even know what kind of cancer you're going to start on?
Well, immune therapies have shown tremendous promise in a range of different tumors, including melanoma, including lung cancer. So we'll be evaluating our medicines in a range of different tumor types.
And you'll be deciding at a later date.
Yeah, that's right. We'll be making those decisions a bit further down the road. Another important series of studies that we'll do is that in immune therapy, the current theme is combination therapies, where immune therapies are not being given one at a time, but they're being given in combination with each other. The reason being that It was shown several years ago, again with the Bristol-Myers drug Yervoy, that a small percentage of patients, about 10% of patients with late-stage melanoma, go into long-term durable remission. This is a spectacular result and advance in the treatment of melanoma. But wouldn't it be better, even better, if that 10% number was a lot higher? And so the field is combining now multiple immunotherapies to try to get more patients into long-term response, long-term remission. Now, perhaps not surprisingly, combination immunotherapy is even more toxic than individual chemotherapy because you're activating the immune system even more. And at ASCO, the American Society of Clinical Oncology Conference in Chicago, this really was a theme of the conference, that in combination therapies, we're seeing tremendous responses in patients. We're seeing long-term responses in patients, but we're also seeing even more severe toxicity. And so the buzz, if you like, in the conference was, how can we create the next generation of safer, more effective immune therapies so that patients go into long-term remission but also have a better experience along the way?
So you may be out there saying, even though we're working on what we're working on, other people may want to work with you to see if they can't make their own compounds more or have less side effects.
Exactly right. And that's exactly what we're doing. For example, with Bristol-Myers, you know, one of the leaders in the field, is we're in active collaboration with them to make safer, more effective versions of certain of their molecules for exactly that reason.
Well, Sean, thank you so much. Please come back. Keep us updated, won't you?
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Sean McCarthy is the CEO of CytomX Therapeutics. More information is available on the web at cytomx.com. That's CYTOMX, cytomx.com. For Biotech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment Biotech Nation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Muller, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancourt.